From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a nor'easter and historic high tides leave coastal areas reeling. Our Week in Review looks back at yesterday's big storm.
Let's face it, if I have to go back over 25 years to come up with a time in which we had flooding that reached the level we saw today, that's a very long time.
Also, the Trump administration's reversal of an Obama-era policy on marijuana and what it means to legalization efforts in states like Massachusetts.
In a place where it's where you're just getting started, it creates a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace, and so it can really start to slow down or solve things.
It's all part of our Week in Review. Also, Congressman Stephen Lynch on just how bad 2017 was for Democrats and how that could change in the new year. And parishioners from New Bedford are trying to get their historic church bells back from Cincinnati. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everyone. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our Week in Review, beginning with the aftermath of the year's first big winter storm, which dumped up to a foot and a half of snow, knocked out power, closed schools, brought much of the state to a standstill. The nor'easter, along with historic high tides, brought flooding to coastal communities, including Boston's waterfront. Here's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh.
If anyone wants to question global warming, just see where the flood zones are. Those zones didn't flood 30 years ago, some of those areas. Some of those areas did, but I think this is a reminder today of what could happen in a storm like this.
State Secretary of Transportation Stephanie Pollack warns of continued transportation delays.
The buses may continue to be affected by road conditions, may continue to run on snow routes, may continue to see delays that are beyond the control of our bus operators.
And now comes a weekend deep freeze. Here's WBUR meteorologist David Epstein.
We're not looking at winds as strong as we saw yesterday. However, the winds will be strong enough to keep wind chill values below zero today, tonight, Saturday, Saturday night, and early Sunday.
Well, joining us now in the studio to discuss this and the rest of the week's news is Susan Tracy, president of the Democratic consulting firm, The Strategy Group. She's also a former state rep. Susan, thanks for coming in. Always good to see you.
Thanks, Anthony.
And Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Richard, always good to see you as
well. Nice to be back.
So cities and towns are cleaning up. How did they do in your neck of the woods? Richard, let me start with you.
I'm out in Wakefield, and everything actually was done pretty well.
Yeah?
Windy, but and a lot of snow, but very well handled.
Yeah. What did you see, Susan?
I'm in Newton. I live on the end of a dead-end street, so I'm usually like the last in the line for plowing. And so far, so good. So they didn't seem to do a nice job up there.
All right. Well, I want to talk about the flooding we heard at the top of the show. Governor Charlie Baker was asked about it, about sort of the historical context of the flooding last night. Here's a little of what he said.
My own memory, the most significant flooding I ever saw outside of the city along the coast was actually the no-name storm in the 90s. Let's face it, if I have to go back over 25 years to come up with a time in which we had flooding that reached the level we saw today, that's a very long time.
So we also heard reports of flooding in the Seaport District, Fort Point, Long Wharf, Barnstable, Marshfield, Scituate, Hull, Winthrop, Quincy, Chatham, Gloucester, to name just a few. Susan, I mean, this is, like Charlie Baker said, you've got to go back a long way to, recall when there was flooding like this. Is this an important warning about climate change? How do you read this?
Well, I think we've had a lot of important warnings about climate change. I think the science is there. I think, you know, even those of us who have a long horizon on storms, sadly, I'm one of those people now, I think we'd all agree that it just seems different these days. Katrina's and Maria's, and just, it's just something that I don't think any of us are used to. And the really dramatic temperature swings, you know, these bitter cold days and then these boiling warm days in winter. So I think we'd all agree. I mean, something's up. This is not the norm as we know it.
I agree. Richard, does this mean that we need better plans to get ready for, to sort of to respond to global warming? And you think Boston is doing it?
Well, I think you have to actually look to the future and do have a plan in place, because climate change is taking place. It's taken place throughout the whole history of the Earth. But I do think that this was a bad storm, and obviously the flooding aspect I would think back to this blizzard of 78, which is what everybody compares it to. But I do think that the news media, you know, back in 1978 and back when I was growing up, people accepted being New Englanders, I think, a little more than they do now.
You mean it's winter, it's snowing, get over it.
And I think there's a lot more media outlets right now, and everybody hypes it up. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a, you know, we're New England and we're going to get pretty, pretty, you know, tough
put your
storms
boots
on occasion.
I mean, I agree, but there's also a social media aspect to this that sort of hypes it up. But on some of those pictures yesterday, when you see dumpsters sort of float down on Atlantic Avenue in Boston, it does sort of make you wonder. But speaking of this, the city's Climate Ready Boston report brought up the idea of a seawall, much like the one that's under construction in Venice, Italy, that would run through Boston Harbor to protect the city from rising sea levels and storm surge. Price tag, $10 billion. What do you think, Susan?
Well, $10 billion is going to be problematic.
But sooner or later, it adds up to real money.
Right? Yeah, exactly. But I do think we have to do something, especially when you look at the amount of development that's taking place in the city. I mean, you know, $10 billion there, but there's billions and billions of dollars of pretty important assets at stake. So I think, you know, we can keep looking the other way, or we can say, you know, we care about the future of our city and we need to do something.
And in a place like the seaport, I think you can put a lot of thought into potentially, you know, what could happen. I mean, some of the development, you know, we're in a development boom right now, and it's probably worthwhile to review everything that's taking place as to whether or not it's going to be able to stand up to the changes that are taking place in the climate, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road.
So let me ask you both about how you think the MBTA fared, or maybe it's better to say, how is it faring? We've got a lot of cold weather coming this weekend. WBUR spoke with Luis Ramirez, the new general manager of the MBTA. He talked about a $100 million investment in new third rails, plowing equipment, new training, and a new emergency response operations center. Here's what he said.
I think in the past 3 years, what you can see is that we've spent a lot of time actually reviewing all of our procedures and really trying to get the system and the people trained in a way to really deal with these types of challenges.
So we all remember the winter of 2015 and how it paralyzed the T. Governor Baker made reorganizing the MBTA one of his priorities. The storm caused some delays, but overall, was this a successful test to the governor's plan to overhaul the MBTA, Richard?
I would give him a good mark, the MBTA, because, I mean, there are certain things you can't do anything about, obviously. You can't have ferries running with the waves and the conditions that we just saw. Buses, obviously, you have the streets in pretty bad shape. But overall, I think, you know, 3 years ago, the T just pretty much collapsed. And it collapsed because there had been 30 years of non-investment in some of the capital, the non-sexy items, you know, like signal, infrastructure.
And, right.
And those were, some of those were 100 years old, the signals, and they just couldn't hold up to the weather. So, you know, the plan that was put in place, the $100 million, I think, is, you know, maybe not as much as, perfect, but it was certainly a pretty sizable contribution. And I think, you know, going for, and I don't want people to think that's the only thing that's been going on at the T, because there are big ticket items, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent. You know, the orange and the red line, cars are going to be coming in. They're all going to be new. So there's a lot of work that's going on and I think they passed the test.
Yeah. What do you think, Susan? Do you agree?
Couple of thoughts. I think, you know, 2015 certainly was a low bar. I mean, we shut down our transit system, and that just shouldn't happen in a major city. So I think we had, we had nowhere to go but up, and we needed to go up. So I didn't take the T today, so I don't know that I'm the right person to speak to whether it all worked. I do think, just from what I pick up on social media and what I pick up in the media, it doesn't seem that people are complaining as much. It doesn't seem that you've had, you know, sort of Twittersphere go crazy saying I've been standing here in the bitter cold for 20 minutes. I do agree with an earlier point that you made, Richard, which is we live in New England, and, you know, these storms are hard, and I think sometimes we put too much pressure on government to, like, have everything, you know, buffed up and clean and ready to roll in a matter of minutes. This is a lot of work. And so it appears that things went really well. I guess, you know, we'll have to see if that's true, but that's what it seems. And, you know, we need it to go well, because that infrastructure is critical.
I would say there are a lot of politics that are centered around the MBTA right now, because I do think 3 years ago when the T pretty much shut down, that was really the incident, you know, and it was over a couple of weeks that really people got to know Charlie Baker. He had just been sworn into office, and all of a sudden he was dealing with this. He probably got millions and millions of dollars worth of publicity, and just, again, people seeing him on TV, getting to know who he was. He owns the MBTA right now. If anything goes wrong, when that storm started and we recognized the severity of it, you know, the first thing I thought is, oh, I hope Charlie makes it through without a huge problem.
Well, so far, so good.
If there is a problem, it's going to be amplified and it's going to become political.
Well, let's move on because I want to talk about some other stories. Storms are big tests for mayors. This week's storm hit just days after a number of mayors were sworn into office. Framingham's Yvonne Spicer was sworn in as the city's first ever mayor. Ruth Ann Fuller became the new mayor of Newton. Thomas McGinn in Lynn. And here in Boston, Mayor Marty Walsh was inaugurated for his second term on Monday. And the big theme of his inaugural address, a commitment to make Boston work for everyone, including the working and middle classes. Here's a bit of what he said.
We have to show a way forward. In my second term, I will prioritize the fundamentals of the middle class opportunity in our world-class city. Strong 21st century schools, good jobs, affordable homes in safe neighborhoods, a better Boston for everyone.
So, Susan, I'll start with you because you're a Boston native. Did you like Mayor Walsh's hopeful vision for the future? What did you think of the address?
I did. I was there on Monday, and I think that's the right place to be and the right tone. I think a lot of people feel that sort of at the top of the ladder, whether it's from a housing or jobs perspective, that part of our city is doing pretty well. And I think he spoke to homelessness and some of, you know, those in most in need as well. So I think we should say that. But for Boston to really go forward and survive and to be the great city that it is and continue to be, it needs a middle class and it needs a working class. And I actually was really pleased that he made that a priority in his speech.
It's a big riddle, though, isn't it? I mean, a city that is sort of a world-class innovation center, financial services center, it's bringing lots of high-paying jobs. But by definition, that's going to put pressure on the middle and lower classes as it has. What did you hear in Mayor Walsh's second inaugural address?
Well, I think the mayor did a great job in his first term, and I think laying out in his second term, I was interested in ensuring that there's a middle class in Boston, but also the development that's taking place. I think he's done a pretty good job right now, and I don't think people recognize just how much development's going on. He really has the opportunity to really put his print on the city for many, many decades to come. And I think he's managed things well so far. And people like him. And I think they feel people feel very comfortable with him and think that he has a good leadership style. And the second term is going to be harder than the first in a way because you have problems that don't go away. The school system still needs to be improved. And there are other areas that, there is a housing crisis in the city. But overall, I think people are very happy with the direction.
I want to ask you both about a former Vice President Joe Biden, who was there presiding over the event. He was sort of there as a guest of honor. And he picked up on this sort of need to prop up the middle class. And he said that the most progressive thing leaders can do is to invest in things that can change people's lives. Here's what he said.
From access to continuing education after high school, to universal health coverage, to affordable child care, job training, a fair tax system. I could go on, but I won't. Because it means we're not only giving middle-class people the ability to fulfill their dreams, we're giving the poor a way up. We're giving them hope.
Former Vice President Joe Biden. Now, a bunch of people have noted that sounded like a speech not only of a guy just doing his buddy Mayor Walsh a solid and showing up on inauguration, but it sort of sounded like a guy who was running a political candidate. What did you think, Susan, the idea of Joe Biden sort of kicking off a campaign there in Boston?
I think that that's a fair observation. I'm sure he hasn't gotten it out of his system yet. He's been in elected life for a very long time. He's out now. I'm sure he watches what's going on nationally the way many people do and says, you know, this isn't the way it should be. He's part of the Obama legacy, and I'm sure it is really hard to watch, you know, the, you know, attempt to dismantle that. So, you know, I got to believe the pilot light is still on somewhere. Yeah. Whether he does it or not remains to be seen. But
well, you're a Democratic consultant. Yeah. What do you think? I mean, is he a viable candidate? I mean, the issue of his age is always raised. But would you be comfortable with the Democrats getting behind someone like Joe Biden?
Yeah, I think he's a viable candidate. I mean, if Mitt Romney is a viable candidate, I would think they're about the same age, aren't they? Yes, absolutely. He's a man who has served as vice president to an extremely popular Democratic president who served in the United States Senate. And absolutely, I think he is someone who could very well be a candidate. Whether he will be or not, don't know, but sure.
Yeah. What do you think, Richard?
As a Republican, I'm rooting for Elizabeth Warren, who noticeably was absent from that particular event.
Well, she was out in Framingham, with Yvonne Spicer, right?
She was, yeah.
But I think in his case, you know, in Biden's case, Marty Walsh is exactly the type of Democrat that he needs to get behind him, and that would be attracted to him if he ends up running. So, I mean, it was a smart political move to go and in his type of constituency, I think.
Yep.
Well, let's move on. I want to touch on marijuana. The Trump administration yesterday ended an Obama-era policy that could have a big impact on Massachusetts and states like Massachusetts, where pot has been legalized. Under federal law, pot remains illegal, though the previous administration discouraged federal prosecutors from enforcing the law in states that have legalized pot. Now, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has freed federal prosecutors essentially to enforce the federal law more aggressively. Governor Baker and Attorney General Maura Healey have come out against this decision. And we spoke to Jim Borgasani, spokesman for the Marijuana Policy Project, commending both of them. Here's a bit of what he said.
Clearly, they are recognizing and respecting the will of voters as expressed in November 2016. Clearly, Jeff Sessions is not.
So, Richard, what did you make of this? I mean, is this a case of the Trump administration not respecting the will of voters in states like Massachusetts and Colorado and elsewhere?
I think it's a case that the voters are ahead of government and that the states are ahead of the federal government on this. And this is just unnecessary. Aaron, if you look at all the nuances of what is being actually done, it doesn't really amount to anything. It's not going to change anything here in Massachusetts. I doubt the new U.S. attorney is going to come in and go after the state. It's pretty clear that he's already come out and said he's not going to change anything within the regulatory structure that's being created here in Massachusetts. With everything going on in Washington, it's amazing. You know, Jeff Sessions, he's got, you know, immigration, he's got terrorism, he's got all these different things to pay attention to, and he's bringing this up as an issue, and it's just Donald Trump's worst appointment.
Well, let me just, you mentioned the U.S. attorney, and we've got the statement from U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling right here. It's a long one. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but here's what reads like a key line to me. I'm not exactly sure how to interpret it. As a result of this new policy, our office will aggressively investigate and prosecute bulk cultivation and trafficking cases and those who use the federal banking system illegally. So, Susan, it doesn't sound like that's going to be a problem for new pot dispensaries or medical marijuana dispensaries or whatever might happen here.
You know, there's two things. I think there's probably is some financing issues that could be at stake because, you know, federally it's still a controlled substance. Most major banks won't lend. So there might be some financing issues that are in play for some or not in play for some, you know, people who want to get into this industry. But what strikes me the most is what a major political stumble that is by Jeff Sessions. I mean, think about this. You know, you're already in a place where you have a president with extremely low popularity ratings, especially with young voters. 71% of young voters support the legalization of you know, sales of marijuana. And now you've given an issue to the millennial voter who, you know, let's face it, isn't always the first to the polls on election day to get ginned up about. You've divided Republicans and Democrats because obviously you get, you know, a senator from Colorado. Yeah.
A Republican senator who was really quite vocal speaking out against it. Yeah.
It's over $2 billion of the Colorado economy right now. So I feel that, you know, even if things don't change, and by the way, all you need is one aggressive U.S. attorney doing something to create a really bad political problem, I think, for the Republicans on this one. So I just think it's dumb if you, you know, if I had to sort of, if you made me pick one word, I don't understand it politically.
You know, there are so many great things going on right now. The stock market is over 25,000. I mean, the economy is really starting to rev up as a result of the tax cuts. And why you would want to shift attention to something like this doesn't make any sense at all. And again, you know, Massachusetts, you have the Cannabis Control Commission right now that just put out regulations. They've set up a framework here in Massachusetts. This isn't going to affect us, I think, in any way, except that it is terrible publicity and a political stumble.
Yeah. I mean, one way that it might affect people, and we've heard this from folks who look at this, is that in a state like Massachusetts that's beginning to set things up, it could actually suppress. I mean, it sort of puts a legal cloud over the marijuana industry and could suppress new investment in it.
Well, there's been a little bit of a legal cloud anyways, because, you know, what really should happen is that the Congress should change the law.
Federally. Right.
But you have Massachusetts law it's been passed by the voters, and there really isn't a question here at all, I think, because you have the governor and you have the attorney general. They're both on the same page. You know, whether you like the question or not, I think most people here in this state respect the will of the voters and understand that there's, you know, it's been decided, there's a process being set up, and to have the federal government intrude upon the state in any way right now, I think there'd be a huge backlash.
All right. We have just enough time for our hubbubs, those little stories or events that caught our attention this week and maybe didn't make it onto the front pages. Susan, let me start with you. What's your hubbub?
Sure. I'm going to give a shout out to Bill Forey at the Dorchester Reporter because, I don't know, probably like hopefully some people listening, I am done with listening to snow stories. And what he does is he reports, he has a hashtag, open and dot, and Billy Forey tells you which bars, restaurants and coffee shops are open when there's a snow day.
Right.
And I don't live in Dorchester, but I like the concept, so I give Billy Forey a shout out.
It's funny you mentioned that, because yesterday I was looking at my Twitter feed and Bill Forey had tweeted out, the Erie Pub is open.
Exactly.
And I thought, all right, that's useful information.
Bingo.
That's great. Okay, Richard,
all right,
you're
so up. Mine, given the weather over the last week or so, I admit I did a double take when I saw this story. I thought it would be a good hubbub. Do you know that Sunday, January 7th, is the 17th annual No Pants Subway Ride that's going to take place in Boston and a number of other cities around the country and around the world?
No pants.
Now, according to the post, the Facebook post for the group, during the No Pants Subway Ride, participants will ride in various T-lines wearing all of their normal winter clothes with the minor exception of missing pants. You heard that right. That's the most important part of the ride, is that the participants have to act as though nothing is out of the ordinary. And I guess this started as a prank 17 years ago in New York, and it's grown every year since. So if people want to participate, they can go to the Facebook page and
mark your calendars.
Yeah,
January,
exactly.
January what?
It's January 7th. But I got to say, okay, would it be better for them to do this in August than right now?
All right. Well, here's my hubbub. It's a shout out to all those people who work outside through the kind of nasty weather we had yesterday. And here on Radio Boston, we heard yesterday from James of Newton, who said he was a mail carrier and who, after working all day delivering the mail on foot, called us to say he was unable to drive down his own street to get home because it hadn't been plowed yet. But he was full of good humor. And here's a bit of our interaction. Thanks for the work you do. What's the motto of the U.S. Postal Service? You're not going to be slowed down.
No, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night shall save these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed route.
All right. So with that sentiment in mind, here's a big thank you to all the first responders, the people plowing, shoveling, the mail carriers, and everyone else who had to work yesterday and every day, including James, the mail carrier from Newton. Richard Tessay, former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate, thanks for coming in. Sure. Have a great weekend. Stay warm. And same to you, Stacey, Susan Tracy, president of the Democratic consulting firm, The Strategy Group. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Anthony. And the post office is hiring.
All right. Stay with us. Coming up, Congressman Stephen Lynch joins us live in the studio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's move on to politics in Washington in the new year. So far, it looks a bit like the old year. Republicans are in charge in Washington. President Trump is busy on Twitter, tweeting this week, for example, that his nuclear button is much bigger and more powerful than North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's nuclear button. There's also the new book published by journalist Michael Wolff, Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House, which prompted a rift between the president and his former top advisor Steve Bannon. Among other things, it portrays a deeply troubling view of a president uninterested or perhaps unable to grasp the complexities of governing. We've been talking this week to members of Massachusetts' congressional delegation about the year ahead in politics, and joining us now is Stephen Lynch, who represents part of Boston and parts of eastern Massachusetts. And Congressman Lynch, thanks so much for coming in.
Good to be with you, Anthony.
It's really good to have you. So you're the lead Democrat on the National Security Subcommittee. How concerned are you about the president's tweets, and specifically this one in North Korea? I mean, how worrying is that to you?
Very, very worrying on a number of levels. I mean, just look at what he's doing with the budget. He's right now proposing a 31% cut to the State Department. We've got vacancies in the ambassadorship in Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the EU. So we've got a bunch of vacancies out there. It's rather scattershot in terms of what the president's priorities might be at any one given time. We've got, basically total denial by the Republican Oversight Committee with respect to Russian hacking of our election system. And also, we've got some serious concerns with respect to the, financial networks, SWIFT and others, where we've got North Korean hacks that have been successful. So from a national security perspective, the current approach by the president is extremely troubling.
Mm. I want to ask you about one point that sort of came out of this, all of this brouhaha we've been hearing about Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. And he writes that when President Trump decided to fire FBI Director James Comey, he did it pretty much entirely on his own without the knowledge or advice of his closest advisors. And yesterday I read this by Michelle Goldberg, who wrote a column about this in the New York Times. I just want to read this quote to you. In presidential annals, the firing of FBI Director James Comey may be the most consequential move ever made by a modern president acting entirely on his own. Now, imagine Trump taking the same approach toward ordering the bombing of North Korea. It's sort of a frightening thought. Maybe it's a hyperbolic thought, but I'm just wondering if it's the kind of thought that occurs to you.
I'm not sure it goes to the level of bombing another country, but I certainly think that he gets out there on a limb in many cases without counsel. I guess at this point, my greatest hope is that he listens to some of the people who are knowledgeable around him. That's my only hope at this point. But I've seen enough instances where he has failed to do that. On immigration, on the so-called Muslim ban, he got right out there. It seems to be he's more focused on the campaign promise than how the machinery of government might work. So it's tough to respond to in a logical way or a rational way when you're not sure what is going to pop out of his mouth in terms of a new priority or a new direction.
How do you what's your response to the fact that North Korea and South Korea are going to engage in talks for the first time in a while? And this is happening in spite of President Trump's tweets, not because of them. Is this a good development, or does it look like North Korea might be trying to drive a wedge between South Korea and Washington? What's your view?
I think it's absolutely a good thing. I mean, what's the alternative here?
Yeah.
I've been to North Korea. I've been up to, excuse me, not North Korea. I've been to the
DMZ,
right. We've been over to South Korea a number of times, and I think dialogue is our only hope in that instance, and maybe through economic ties and cultural ties, we can de-escalate the situation there between North and South Korea. And maybe it's just we just need to get out of the way if that's part of the equation to bring those countries together to avoid a disaster.
I'd love to ask you a sort of big picture political question or two about 2017 and looking forward to 2018. So you have a reputation as a moderate Democrat.
Thank you.
That's a good thing.
It is. I think so.
But you're a Democrat from one of the bluest states in the country. So with that in mind, how bad was 2017 in your view?
It was pretty bad. I mean, beginning with President Trump taking office, but also the missed opportunities ever since. I think this recent tax bill was a missed opportunity. I think the run that he made at just a blanket repeal of the Affordable Care Act without regard to the consequences, I think there were opportunities for us to make things a lot better for a lot of people in this country. So it's just been and I think when Trump came into office, he was talking about doing an infrastructure bill, and basically, if we had done the right thing on repatriating a lot of the foreign assets coming back into the United States, we could have funded that without really raising taxes, and we could have rebuilt a lot of infrastructure here, done some good work on climate change. Done great work on rapid transit. Just a missed opportunity. So, there were a lot didn't get done because of Democratic opposition. But I guess I bemoan the fact that, geez, we had a chance to do some really good things here, and we didn't get that opportunity.
Well, let me ask you about the tax bill. I know it doesn't poll very popularly. I know obviously every Democrat voted against it. At the same time, it looks like pretty much most of the folks in the middle class are going to get some kind of tax cut, at least in the early part of the next few years anyway. Isn't that a good thing?
Well, it depends on your age. For young people, this is going to add about $1.5 trillion in debt over the next 10 years. Is that what we should be doing? With an economy with unemployment rate of about 4.8% nationally, should we be piling on another $1.5 trillion in debt for kids who are going to be facing a lot of challenges that we're leaving for them? So, and who do we help here? With unemployment at 4.8%, is this really a jobs bill? I mean, that's almost, a point where the unemployment rate reflects people going from job to job, in between jobs. So it's not like a situation like President Obama had, where you had unemployment at 10% and you were trying to take a good whack at that. So I just don't know what the long-term benefits will be. Remember, the middle-class tax breaks basically phase out after 5 years. However, the corporate tax rate went from 35% to 20% and stays there. That's permanent. Yeah.
That's the case with long-term benefits, and I get that. But I guess I'm asking you, just because it's the nature of politics, that the considerations are so often short-term, right? Mm. And so we're in a political year. Midterms are coming up. And I could just imagine Republicans being in a position of saying, well, Democrats like Stephen Lynch, they were opposed to giving you all a tax cut, last year. What do you say to that?
I'll accept that criticism. To go back to the fact that we're putting $1.5 trillion in debt on our grandchildren and kids, the upside did not justify doing that.
Well, what about 2018? Last month, following the election of Doug Jones in Alabama, who was just sworn in as senator a couple of days ago, you said that was a good sign for Democrats. What do you see ahead in 2018? Big opportunity here to retake the House for Democrats?
Well, I know we'll look, they've got, I think, a 46 or a 47 member advantage on us in the House. So we've got a lot of work to do. I think we can make a serious dent in that. I'm not sure we can get there yet. Election day is a long ways away. However, I do think that people are having second thoughts about having elected this president and having given the Republicans control of the White House, the House, and the Senate. So I think that there's the wind's at our backs, I'll say, for the Democrats if we take advantage of it.
And what does that mean, Congressman?
Well, remember, the places so Hillary won by over 1 million votes in Massachusetts. There's, you know, we got all the electoral votes we could get. But we need to really – the people we need really need to speak to are people in the Midwest and the South and try to push an agenda that includes them. A lot of those people voted for Trump because their towns, their cities had been wiped out in terms of jobs by foreign trade. So Trump comes in and says, hey, look, I'll tear up that NAFTA. So cities and towns in the Midwest who had lost – millions and millions and millions of jobs saw him as their savior. That's a Democratic idea, and we didn't talk about that very much in the elections. We talked about we're going to put coal miners out of work. You know, that's not going to get you a whole lot of votes in West Virginia and Kentucky. To believe me, we lost every single state in Appalachia, and you know that used to be an area that was really convinced that the Democrats were on the side of the angels and were acting in their best interest. So we've got some work to do, but we've got to figure out a way to make the Democratic Party relevant to the lives of working people in the Midwest and in the South and all over the country, not just the coasts.
Is there, and if there is, I'd love you to describe it, is there a sort of debate, a split in the Democratic Party right now? A moment ago, I referred to you as a moderate Democrat. In this state, we've got people who are sort of further out on the left, like Elizabeth Warren, for example. Is that the model of progressivism that is going to speak to these people? Or does Congressman Stephen Lynch say, we've got to be more moderate and hew a little bit more toward the middle to
right.
reach those folks?
The latter. We have to hew more to the center. I mean, that was the success of Bill Clinton.
So do the Democrats shoot themselves in the foot if they put their eggs in the Elizabeth Warren basket or the Bernie Sanders basket or, I don't know, maybe even the Joe Biden basket?
I don't think so. But those candidates have to, you know, refocus and make sure that some of the, you know, the lunchbox issues that are important to, you know, blue-collar, lunch-bucket Democrats are being talked about. You know, half-joking, I said, you know, the last election, we talked more about free-range chicken than we did about working people. I was only half-kidding because we really did get out there on the edge on some of these issues. And, you know, if Trump is talking about, you know, tearing up NAFTA and we're talking about, you know, I don't know, you know, a fringe issue, not that they're not important, but you got to have the meat and potatoes in terms of what's really important to people in order to get their attention. And I think the reason Trump's in office is because people forgot what the Democratic Party was all about and why the Democratic Party was important to them. And we let them forget.
You were at Marty Walsh's second inauguration, and we heard from former Vice President Joe Biden, who delivered a pretty full-throated sort of defense of the middle class and what has to happen to sort of restore the middle class idea here in America. Was that a message that resonated as one that the Democrats should really wrap themselves around?
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe he got it right.
Yeah.
And I think that. You know, I know some people talk about his age, but, you know, he doesn't show me any sign of slowing down. And I think especially in the context of you know, President Trump, I think, you know, Joe Biden's looking really good right now.
We also have a race for governor here in Massachusetts this year. I'd love to ask you about that and put this in context because much was made of this. You said recently that you would consider voting for Charlie Baker in 2018 on a Boston Herald podcast. What was the context of that? And were you saying you would consider voting for him over a viable Democrat?
Well, so somewhere in one of the campaigns, they had made an allegation that that Charlie Baker, because he had given money to the Republican National Committee, was actually supporting a pedophile in Alabama.
Roy Moore.
So they made that. And so I said, that's a bit much. I said, that's like me, you know, supporting the Democrats and being blamed for the conduct of Al Franken. I said, you know, it just that's a stretch. Mm-hmm. And so they said, and I said, by the way, you know, Charlie Baker is actually a good and decent man, which I truly believe.
Yeah.
And so that's when they said, well, would you consider voting for him? And then I said, well, yeah, you know, because it's a long way from Election Day, and you know the issues haven't really been refined yet. But I think that Charlie Baker is worthy of consideration for a person's vote right now, at least from where I sit.
And what about the three Democrats, Seti Warren, Jay Gonzalez, and Bob Massey? Are you on the sidelines, or do you think?
Pretty much on the sidelines. All right.
So the question might be, why not declare your support for one of them? They're one of your fellow Democrats.
I don't know enough about them yet. Okay. I think they're out there. They're, you know, I get emails. I think I'm on all their lists, so I get the campaign stuff on a regular basis. But I think it's fair to say that they haven't really defined themselves yet and what their administration would look like.
Well, that's obviously part of their challenge in the year ahead.
Right.
Congressman Stephen Lynch, he represents Massachusetts' 8th Congressional District, which includes parts of eastern Massachusetts and parts of Boston. Congressman, great pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for coming in. Anthony, my pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In New Bedford, a group of parishioners from the St. Lawrence Martyr Church are trying to retrieve 14 bells that had hung in the church tower for almost 130 years. The bells are on their way to Cincinnati. They were in need of repair, so this past November, the church sold them to the Cincinnati-based Verdon Bell Company and will use the proceeds to make much-needed structural repairs to their church. But the parishioners say the bells belong in New Bedford, and they're trying to raise $75,000 to get them back. Suzanne Sullivan is leading the fundraising effort, and she joins me now from Fairhaven. Suzanne Sullivan, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony. Thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so tell us a little about these bells, why they're so important to you and your fellow parishioners in New Bedford.
All right, Anthony. These bells were put up, actually it's 130 years ago last week, and these bells were put up by people that saved so much money and worked so hard. They were immigrants, a lot of them, and they were put up in honor of God and of, you know, all the work they had done. And these bells are just very, very special. They're a 14-bell chime. They can play any kind of music. They're just beautiful. And we feel they're historically important to the city of New Bedford. St. Lawrence Church is the one of the fourth oldest churches in New England. And these bells have been up longer than the bells at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. And they are absolutely beautiful. And to have them leave the city that they came to in 1888 is just beyond our comprehension.
I understand, and I hear how much they mean to you. So the bells, as we mentioned, could be headed to Cincinnati, but I understand that the Verdon Bell Company says they'll let you have them back for the cost of the bells and what they spent taking them down, which is about $75,000. Right. So how close are you to reaching your fundraising goal?
Well, we are approaching 60,000. We're in the mid 50,000, and we've done that in a month, and it's been remarkable. The people that have helped us, it's just unbelievable. It has totally renewed my faith in human beings, because people I don't know, people we do know, I mean, everybody has just been so wonderful. And we've made a lot of money in a short period of time. And the Verdon Bell Company has been very, very good with us as far as giving us this time. They have extended it.
So how long do you have to raise? What? So you're about $12,000 or $15,000 short.
Yeah, about that, Anthony. About that. We have another probably 10 days, 8 to 10 days. But I really think our lawyer spoke with them the other day, and they said they're so impressed with what we've done that they just can't get over it, and that they're just willing. I think they're really willing to work with us to finish this up, so that the Bells will not leave New Bedford. And I think they realize that the Bells shouldn't have been sold the way they were, and they realize that. And I think that they are working with us because they feel that it was not done properly.
Well, we reached out to the folks at the St. Lawrence Martyr Church and the Fall River Diocese, and they referred us to a statement which came out, I believe, last year, which said that they decided to sell the Bells because it would cost much more to repair them. And the sales of the bells netted $32,000 for the parish, which will go toward much-needed building repairs. So, right. So what's wrong with that logic? Isn't it worth giving up the bells to preserve the historic church building?
Absolutely not. I worked at the parish as a volunteer for 4 years, from 2010 to 2014, and we raised close to $380,000 to work on this tower and stabilize the bells. The bells are in perfect condition. They needed the electronic system to be updated. Those bells would have stayed up there another 150 years without a problem. It was the tower that needed to be fixed, and we had raised the money for that. So now what they claim is that there's $1 million worth of work to be done. Well, $30,000 for bells that are worth at least three times that amount of money, it doesn't make any sense. It's just not logical whatsoever.
Well, Suzanne, it sounds like you're well on your way toward this $75,000 goal. If you get that money and you're able to repurchase the bells, what's the next step? First of all, where will they go? They're not going to go back in the original church tower.
No, they can't. Unfortunately, that's where they should be, but they're not going to be, because once that would happen, the church would own the bells again, which is not an option. So we would talk with the city. The councilors, the mayor, and all the people in the city, the Historic Commission, the Preservation Society, to work toward a good place to put them, whether it be the waterfront down in New Bedford, Fort Tabor in the South End, Common Park. We would have a structure built, and we would work probably with the Verdon Bell Company to get them electrified and ringing again. We want them all to ring again.
So, Suzanne, if people are listening to this and they want to help, how should they get in touch with you?
Well, the best way at this point is really to get in touch with me personally, because we're on such a short timeline here. We have a lawyer, and checks have been going to his office, but it's better now for people to really send them to me.
All right. And Suzanne, I'm just informed by my producer that we have a link on our website, radioboston.org, which explains to people how to get in touch directly with you.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
All right.
Thank you. And when you said, Anthony, if we get it, it's not if, Anthony, we're going to get it. We are going to get it. We're going to get the money. We're going to keep the bells.
All right. Well, it sounds like you are indeed. So that's, go ahead, Suzanne.
We also are going to, anybody who gives money in memory of anybody, we're going to do a plaque of some kind or some kind of a memory booklet, and we'll have a big celebration.
All right. Well, that's Suzanne Sullivan from Fairhaven. She's spearheading the fundraising efforts to buy back 14 historic bells to bring them back to New Bedford. Suzanne Sullivan, thanks so much, and have a happy New Year.
Thank you, Anthony. You also. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Finally today, we at Radio Boston want to say goodbye and thank you to our senior producer, Kathleen McNerney. Kathleen joined Radio Boston almost 5 years ago, and since then, she's been an indispensable part of our team. Those of us who have the privilege of sitting behind this microphone from time to time to bring all of you the news, the interviews, the produced pieces, rely on the patience, the dedication, and the talent of our producers, who toil behind the scenes, often without the recognition and the thanks that they deserve. Kathleen has all of that in spades: patience, dedication, and talent. She also has an abundance of good humor, and everyone here at Radio Boston is going to miss her. That includes me. Now, the good news for us and for you is that she's not going far. In fact, she'll be relocating to a desk just a few feet away from us, working as editor with WBUR's Edify team focusing on education coverage. So Radio Boston's loss is Edify's gain. Still, we will miss her. So best of luck in the new job, Kathleen. And from everyone at Radio Boston, thank you. And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Zoe Mitchell and Anna Saldinger and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.